is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehias Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
WHO is preparing to airlift critically needed medicines, medical supplies, and equipment to Tigray. The first shipment of this is expected to be dispatched this Friday.
That's WHO spokesman Christian Lindemeyer, who says airlifts will soon add to the flow of crucial goods to northern Ethiopia. Details coming up. Also, U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan meets Nigeria's Chief of Staff and Nigeria's National Security Advisor at the White House. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. Tunisian President Kais Saied has dissolved the Supreme Judicial Council, which is mandated to ensure the independence of the judicial system and tasked with appointing most of the nation's judges. The move further consolidates power around Saied after he took sole control of the country last July and eliminates the final check on his power. Michelle Bachelet, UN Human Rights Chief, described the move as a big step in the wrong direction. Spokesperson for the U.S. State Department, Ned Price, said it is essential for Tunisia to respect the independence of the judiciary. Former Tunisian Minister of Parliamentary Affairs, Khalid Chouket, discussed these developments with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El Shenawi.
President Kais Saied has no right, constitutional or legal basis, to dissolve the Supreme Judicial Council. He's taking this step in insistence on his part to continue his coup against the Constitution of the Second Republic, which he started last July 25, and another evidence that reveals his project to demolish the democratic system and bow dictatorial regime in its place. The dissolution of the Judicial Supreme Council after the dissolution of the parliament a few months ago means, in practice, the transfer of all executive, legislative, and judicial powers to the hands of the president, a matter that Tunisia has never known since its independence, even under the authoritarian regimes that existed before the revolution. It is terrible disregard for the most important principles of democracy and a real sabotage of the institutions of the Tunisian state.
The president has initiated an online public consultation before drafting a new constitution that he says will be put to a referendum. He has not brought major political or civil society players into this process. Without a parliament, what's your take on that?
My opinion, the constitution is the supreme law. In Tunisia, the constitution on the First Republic was written in 1959 and the constitution of the Second Republic in 2014 through the same mechanism, which is the National Constituent Assembly elected by the people. That is why a single person cannot, even the president, write a constitution. And if he did, this constitution would not have value or legitimacy and would not be binding on Tunisians. Online consultation is not a referendum, nor is an election, not to mention that this consultation is a kind of escape and evasion of the participatory principles that oblige the president to dialogue with political parties and civil society. The constitutional amendment requires the approval of parliament, and parliament is closed by order of the president, as everyone knows.
Senator Chris Murphy, a Democratic from Connecticut, said Tunisia was the place where the Arab Spring started and stood as a proof that democracy could succeed, and now we are left scrambling with a quasi-dictator and real uncertainty as to which way this country is heading. He called on the Biden administration to signal to President Saied that the U.S. relationship with Tunisia will suffer greatly if the president doesn't change course. With the U.S. pressure and delaying multi-billion dollar loan from the International Monetary Fund and the $500 million infrastructure grant from the U.S. force President Saeed to take Tunisia back to a democratic transition?
I hope that the majority, whether in Congress or in the administration of President Biden, will think the same way as Senator Murphy, who knows the Tunisian file very well and has a clear commitment to supporting a democracy in Arab and Muslim country that until a few months ago was a model for promising democracy in the Arab and Islamic world. The United States has had close relations with Tunisia for more than two centuries and is the most prominent supporter of the democratic transition in Tunisia since 2011. Today, it has a great responsibility to help Tunisians restore the democratic transition to its natural course after the overthrow of the constitution 6 months ago. We do not want sanctions that harm the Tunisian people, but we want firm and clear positions from the Biden administration and from the Congress that affirm Washington's firm opposition to the emerging dictatorship project led by the President Kais Saied.
That was former Tunisian Minister of Parliamentary Affairs Khalid Choket speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El Shenawi. The World Health Organization reports insecurity and bureaucratic barriers continue to prevent much-needed medical supplies and other crucial supplies from reaching millions of people in conflict areas of northern Ethiopia. Lisa Schlein reports.
An estimated 9.4 million people in northern Ethiopia's Tigray, Amhara, and Afar regions are in desperate need of humanitarian assistance. Millions are suffering from severe food shortages. Acute malnutrition is rising. Disease and chronic illnesses are going untreated. The World Health Organization reports dozens of mobile health and nutrition teams are operating across the three regions. However, treating those in need remains challenging. It says essential medical equipment and medical supplies, vaccines, and basic medicines are not reaching the people in need. WHO spokesman Christian Lindemeyer says the situation is particularly critical in Tigray. He says the number of people needing health assistance has risen from 2.3 million during the first half of December to an estimated 3.9 million. However, he says there is what he calls light on the horizon. He notes a shipment of medical supplies reached Mekele, the capital of Tigray, at the end of January. And, he adds, the Ethiopian government has announced it would facilitate daily relief flights to augment the transportation of crucial goods by land.
WHO is preparing to airlift critically needed medicines, medical supplies, and equipment to Tigray. The first shipment of this is expected to be dispatched this Friday, 11 February, when 10 metric tons of the total 33 metric tons of supplies will be airlifted. Most clearances for this have been secured, and the remaining permits will be processed over the next few days.
Nevertheless, he says humanitarian agencies are being forced to downsize their operations because they are running out of supplies, fuel, and cash. He warns these operations may have to shut down in the coming weeks if the situation does not improve. He says an integrated measles campaign at the end of January highlights some of the difficulties aid agencies run into. The campaign, he says, targeted nearly 800,000 children under age 5 using vaccines provided by the Ethiopia Ministry of Health.
And during this phase, 145,000 children of the targeted population were reached because the campaign faced challenges including cash, lack of fuel, and cold chain capacity.
Lindmeyer says WHO continues to negotiate with the authorities for access to the regions. Despite ongoing difficulties, he says some things are moving, and that is a good development. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Zimbabwe schools are finally open again, but very little learning has taken place due to a nationwide strike by teachers who say they cannot afford food, housing, school fees for their kids, and even transport to get to work. From Harare, reporter Kuzaza Nwachi has the details.
In a bid to save the day, the government announced a series of measures yesterday they are taking to get teachers back into classrooms. These include a 20% raise, $100 cash, school fees for three biological children, housing loans, and importation of vehicles on tax exemption. John Warure is a parent of two school-going children. He says they'll be relieved if teachers are back in the classroom.
We can only be hopeful if the teachers are happy.
Obed Masarawure is the leader of the Amalgamated Rural Teachers Union of Zimbabwe. He says the government is offering too little.
We reject the 20% offer from government. It doesn't meet the demands of the teachers, it doesn't meet our expectations as a profession. We are not asking for increments. We are asking for the restoration of our pre-October 2018 salaries, salaries which were arbitrarily withdrawn from us by the employer. And we have gone for 5 years, hoping that maybe at some point the government would restore our salaries.
Warure says the government should be committed to providing a permanent solution.
As a concerned parent, I would actually challenge the government to stop this issue of politicking and adequately address the demands of the teachers. And this can only be done by a consultative, not a unilateral process like what has been done.
While teacher strikes are not new to Zimbabwe, critics worry that with COVID-19 pandemic causing long school closures, the country's education sector and its children will suffer long-term damage. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zinawashi from Harare.
The security advisor to Congolese President Felix Tshisekedi, Francois Biya, was arrested last Saturday by the country's National Intelligence Agency on suspicion of undermining state security. The arrest, according to the French news agency AFP, occurred while Tshisekedi was attending an African Union summit in Ethiopia. The incident sparked fears of instability with the Congolese government and even rumors of an attempted coup. Presidential spokesman Tharcisse Kosongo, in his first official comments on the situation, said on national television that no attempt to destabilize the nation's democratic institutions will be tolerated. Tshisekedi returned home Saturday night with his entourage, denying he had cut short his trip. The arrest of the key security advisor to the president comes as the Congolese government is struggling to stop the conflict with armed groups that has been raging in the country's east. The South African government's considering an application by national energy company Eskom to raise electricity rates by more than 20%. Eskom says South Africa's energy crisis will deepen if it does not get more money fast. Africa's most industrialized economy has been suffering blackouts for 15 years. One reason is that Eskom's old coal-fired power stations have not been properly maintained. Darren Taylor reports.
A commission of inquiry has found the chaos at Eskom was caused by the African National Congress administration of Jacob Zuma. It says the former president appointed cronies to plunder the utility. As a result, says Eskom's chief financial officer, Caleb Kassam, it's drowning in debt.
If we're not recovering it through the electricity tariff, our only option then is to approach the shareholder and government to then help deal with the shortfall.
Cape Town, a city governed by the opposition Democratic Alliance, is opposing Eskom's request. Its mayor is Jordan Hill Lewis.
The Eskom doesn't ask government for help. It asks you and me, and boy, have we given it help. We've given it 150 billion rand in bailouts over the last decade. We have paid 307% before this increase in higher prices over the last decade. And it still doesn't work. It is still deep in debt. It hasn't cut costs. And it
according to the latest government statistics, Only about 12 million people out of a population of 60 million can be placed within the bracket of middle class. These are the ones who bear the brunt of soaring energy costs, says Hill Lewis. The poor majority, although expected to pay for electricity, generally don't, simply defaulting on tariffs or using illegal connections. Kasim says it's largely because so few people pay for power that Eskom's constantly forced to raise prices.
We understand the economic circumstances that is facing the country and the economy, but at the end of the day, government has already given us a large amount of equity injections in the recent past, 56 billion, 49 billion, and 32 billion this year, including 21 billion for the next financial year and 20 billion thereafter.
Hill Lewis says Eskom managers rattle off these numbers as if they're nothing. Yet all of this money comes from the pockets of a tiny tax base, expected to fund a company that can't keep the lights on and is nearly bankrupt and obsolete.
You can't keep going to the public to save Eskom, which is in this position not by the fault of the public, but because of mismanagement, corruption, far too much debt too quickly over the course of the last...
But Kasim says no matter what happens, South Africans, already burdened by economic depression worsened by the COVID-19 pandemic, will soon be paying much more to cook, clean, and watch TV.
And ultimately, you need to choose between whether you pay for electricity directly as the consumer or indirectly as the taxpayer. And we understand...
Hill Lewis says it's this gun-against-the-head approach from Eskom and the government that's angering him and many citizens.
We've got no other choice, do we? If this was an insurance company charging us like this, or if this was a local grocery store charging us like this, we would just go elsewhere.
But as he points out, that elsewhere doesn't exist at the moment because the government is intent on supporting Eskom's monopoly on supplying electricity, instead of dissolving the company and allowing independent power producers to generate solar, wind and water energy. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
Refugees are streaming into Uganda from the eastern part of the Democratic Republic of Congo. Thousands are reported to have fled from an attack last week on several villages by Islamist rebels. Catherine Nambi reports from Kampala.
Asylum seekers reportedly started fleeing toward the Uganda border Wednesday night after an attack on local communities by the Allied Democratic Forces, or ADF. The rebels raided Kamango, Nobiri, and in Japan, the villages about 2.5 kilometers from the DRC Uganda border. The violence left an unspecified number of civilians killed and thousands displaced, a majority of whom are being resettled in Uganda's Bundibugyo district. Dr. Joseph Kasumba is the program officer for the Uganda Red Cross program in Bundibugyo.
We received information from our community volunteers that there is a mass exodus of people coming from Congo, probably running from something, maybe from bullets, because bullets were had, fired across. So when the Congolese came in, we gave some emergency support on where to spend the night so that we can figure out these things the next morning. And
Francis Senyonjo is the Assistant Chief Administrative Officer of Bundibugyo District. Senyonjo, who also doubles as the district focal person, told VOA that most of the new asylum seekers have confirmed that ordinary people, or wananchi, were fleeing fighting between the rebels and the Uganda People's Defense Forces, or UPDF.
We have got information that ADF manned an attack, and they were looking for one of their colleagues that was in the cells, whom they ran away with, and we've been told they were also looking for drugs and some food. So in the process of doing that, they ended up shooting, you have confirmed, three people dead, and they also disappeared. And when they were Naichi, of course, and when the UPDF retaliated with, again, firing at them, the wananchi had to run away for their dear lives. And that's why we have very big numbers of asylum seekers.
So far, 13,000 refugees have been registered at transit centers. However, Senyonjo says there could be even more, since some skipped the formal registration for asylum seekers.
There are those that are not willing to go to the transit center. They are saying the transit center is far away from their home, and they want at any one time to be going back to check on their home. So we are still hassling that one out with them. And then two, there is another sick group of them that have fused into the local community, because some of their relatives are within Uganda. Those ones, as the district local government, we are going to take up that assignment. We shall look for them with the local LOC leadership, and we'll take them to the center where they're supposed to be.
This comes as the armies of Uganda and the DRC embark on the second phase of their joint pursuit of the ADF rebels currently operating in the forests of the Congo. Major Peter Mugisha is the Ugandan spokesperson for the operation, codenamed Operation Shuja, named after a fearsome adult gorilla. He describes the ADF attack as a diversionary tactic by the militants against the two-month-long operation. Mugisha has called for increased vigilance in case the ADF tries to leave the eastern DRC for their original base in the mountains of Uganda.
I would like to inform the public, more especially those who are neighboring who are near the borderline, to be watchful, because ADF might use this opportunity when refugees are running away from Congo. They also join them so that they come into Uganda and begin causing havoc.
Nabil Village, which was attacked by the ADF, is the base for Ugandan soldiers pursuing the rebels. The army has vowed to continue the operation until all ADF remnants are driven out. This is Catherine Nambi for VOA News in Kampala.
U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan met yesterday at the White House with Nigeria's Presidential Chief of Staff Ibrahim Gambari and National Security Advisor Babagana Monguno. Spokesperson Emily Horn says the agenda included shared concerns about democratic backsliding and political instability in West Africa, and the importance of efforts by the Economic Community of West African States to reverse military takeovers and restore constitutional order in Burkina Faso, Guinea, and Mali. Sullivan conveyed U.S. support for Nigeria's preparations for free and fair elections in 2023 and the fight against violent extremist and terrorist groups. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.
Host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and the artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
Join me, Heidi Adams, on a Voice of America Town Hall special as we discuss the coronavirus pandemic and where it will take us next. Join us for COVID-19, the virus, variants, and vaccines on the next Straight Talk Africa, this Wednesday at 18:30 UTC.